Hello and welcome to the Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, merchandise, an archive of past episodes and information on how you can help keep this podcast running. That's fyrgen.com. Hello once again, friends, and welcome to the Fergan. This episode feels like it's going to be a little bit self-indulgent, and it's reluctantly self-indulgent, I would say. For those of you who are not aware, I am a musician and I have a project, a dark folk music project called Walkensman, which has been active since 2013 and was actually conceived of before then. And my second album that I made with that project is called Fire in the White Stone. And it's a concept album for which I wrote an accompanying short story by the same name. Earlier this year, I recorded an audiobook version of Fire in the White Stone and released that as a podcast episode for patrons. It's also available on Bandcamp and on Spotify. But what I've really wanted to do for some time is to speak about the symbolism that's contained within Fire in the White Stone, because for as short as it is, I did actually make a real effort when I wrote the book in 2019 to pack a huge amount of what I'd learned over my years as a student of heathenry and paganism and esoterica. Lots of ideas that I'd had that I'd learned from other people, some ideas of my own that I'd conjured up, influenced by other people. And I really felt the need to pack a lot of this symbolism into the book. And I don't know how many of you listening to this have read the book, but I've had very little feedback from anyone really on the nature of the symbolism in the book. So to this day, you know, the book is, the story is about 4 years old now, and I'm not sure how much of the symbolism has actually come across. And actually, it's all extremely relevant to the subject matter of the Fergan podcast. It's heavily based on Northwestern European mythology, paganism. The book is, on the surface of it, it's essentially quite a basic hero's journey. And it's heavily inspired by the Grail mythos, by Tolkien, by The Way of Weird, by Brian Bates. And I've never pretended that it's anything particularly original, certainly on the face of it. It's quite a kind of basic and obvious story in some ways, although I still think quite enjoyable to read, and it has its own thing going on. So that was really the purpose of the book. And before I go any further, I will say that for those of you who haven't read the book, this entire episode is going to be one big spoiler. So if you intend to read the story at any point, then I'd suggest that you maybe put this episode down for now, read or listen to the book Fire in the White Stone at a later point. And then come back to this, because we're going to be exploring in detail the themes of it, and it's going to give away the entirety of the story. So I've been looking for a while for someone to have this conversation with, because I didn't want to do this solo. And an online friend of mine, Adam, who runs a couple of excellent channels. He has the channels on Telegram called Satis and Gnostic Intel. And Satis is also a very good Odyssey and YouTube channel with incredible production values. And Adam is someone who is knowledgeable on occult symbolism. And if you go to his channel, you'll see that he is knowledgeable about these things. And he's very good with imagery. He's very good at making connections. And he and I have been discussing doing a podcast episode for, I think, a good 6 months now, but we've just been waiting for the right subject matter in order to do that. And he very kindly agreed to do this episode with me, where he would read the story and put together some notes and thoughts and interpretations of the symbolism therein. So this has been a long time coming. I also think that Adam is going to be an excellent kind of counterpart to me, because Adam comes from, although he is knowledgeable on paganism, he comes at things from a more kind of Gnostic perspective. And when I say Gnostic, he and I are both students and admirers of John Lamb Lash. So it's not the world renouncing Gnosticism that most people misunderstand Gnosticism to be. So Adam is very knowledgeable on that side of things, and he's knowledgeable about the Grail mythos and kind of wider Western occult symbolism. So Adam, it's really, really wonderful to finally be speaking with you. So, and I'm hugely grateful to you for agreeing to do this with me. So welcome to this. And if you could just introduce yourself a little bit and perhaps talk about the Satis channel, where that began, what Satis means, what your purpose with all of that has been. So yeah, welcome, Adam.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction, Dan. It's an honor to be here on the podcast and to join the ever-growing, illustrious pantheon of Fergan guests. So yeah, I've been interested in esoteric topics and occultism for pretty much as long as I can remember, really. And I've had a similar path to yourself, reading the likes of Graham Hancock and Brian Bates, and then going further from there. And I've always had a deep love of fantasy, mythology, seeking hidden knowledge, an interest in the mysteries, and following that path really wherever it takes me. And I'm also very much interested in how narratives can essentially shape our reality. And so I run a, as you said, I run a channel called Satis, which is Latin for enough. And I've been putting out video content on a range of topics, primarily focusing on the occult aspects of esoteric psychology, mythology, and using all of these things as essentially as a framework for how we can seek to better understand ourselves, the world, and how to orientate ourselves within it. And another thing I'm very much interested in is the understanding and the critique of belief systems, as I see belief itself as probably being the most valuable commodity on the entire planet, as belief drives and determines action. And so what I'm trying to do with both Gnostic Intel and Satis is to, you know, with others, to forge a new meta-narrative and a form of what I call living mythology. And living mythology contains within it the dual meaning of a mythology that is both living, as in it's alive, but also a myth that can be experienced, in that you can actually live that myth. And that would operate at the level of the individual, but also the collective. And I've also been doing, I've done some promotional video content for the guys over at Imperium Press. And as I mentioned, I run the Gnostic Intel channel. But yeah, that's me.
Excellent. Yeah. And I'm glad you brought up there the strength of the whole concept of narratives, because it's been kind of a growing theme with the Fergan and my work lately in recent months, that actually when you really analyze what's going on in the world, it becomes very apparent that all power comes from a collective narrative. If we're to look at, for example, the Judeo-Christian religion, the Abrahamic religions, they are as powerful as they are because they've essentially enlisted the entire world in their story. So people like us in Europe, who should never have even had a knowledge or understanding of the Abrahamic law, have become part of that law through its spread. And because we are part of their story, it's become a dominant story. So those who wield narratives, those who are able to strengthen their narrative, and no, that doesn't mean truth. A narrative doesn't need to be objectively true. It can be as subjective as you like. All that matters is the number of people who believe in that narrative, and that's where power comes from, right?
Exactly. We've certainly been enlisted, or at least some of us have been enlisted into playing the roles within that particular narrative. So that's why I see a great importance to step outside of that narrative framework entirely and forge something completely new that is, well, not necessarily new, but something that's actually ancient, and to tap into that, to tap into our own ancestral heritage and then move forward from there.
Yeah, and I mean, that kind of brings us to the topic of this conversation, because that's really, and I think at the time it was more subconscious than anything, but that's really what I tried to do with Fire and the White Stone. I drew upon so much native symbolism and lore and mythology because I wanted to strengthen it. I wanted to bolster it. You know, I felt like it's been too long since people wrote stories honoring the symbolism and the themes of our native Northwestern European ways. And so I wanted to do what I could in my own little way to strengthen that. So that's really where Fire and the White Stone sort of came from. So each of us, Adam and I, have notes that we've put together for this. And this could end up being quite a long episode, but we're going to do our best to kind of keep it as kind of concise as we can whilst still being clear about everything. So did you want to start, Adam? Did you want to, I know that you had some thoughts about the title of it, and I guess parts of this are going to end up almost being kind of like an interview. I guess there might be moments where you'll ask me what my intention was with something. And I'll do my best to answer accurately for those parts. But yeah, how did you want to begin?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I very much see this as a two-way process, probably something a bit different to some of your other interviews. But yeah, I mean, I've heard you say that creation is the ultimate act of worship. And I'd say what you've created here with both Fire in the White Stone, the album, and the accompanying book is most certainly honoring the gods and the ancestors. And
thank you.
Yeah. and I also really see the importance of the role of the bard, particularly at this time, and a society that has no respect for its bards or its storytellers, I would say, is a society that is in steep decline, and a society that really risks losing its soul, or perhaps has already lost much of its soul. So it's kind of great to have begin to see this kind of return of both folk music and also the importance of the storyteller. And something I've been considering is how the bard and the warrior almost occupy this role of symbiosis, as the bard tells of great deeds of the warrior, often with some embellishment. And with the retelling of the tales, the warrior or future warrior aspires to those stories of these great deeds. And at the moment, I would say that we're currently awaiting the man to come, who won't be descending from the clouds, but will instead arise from the folk and be chosen by his folk. So I'd been considering, well, what comes first in this process? Is it the bard or is it the warrior? And just the other day, I was listening to a podcast between Morgoth and Mike from Imperium Press. And Mike just threw out this, it was almost a throwaway line where he answered that question for me. And I'd been pondering this for a while, and suddenly this line just jumped into my head out of nowhere. And it was, just as thought precedes action and lightning precedes thunder, so the bard precedes the warrior.
And Mike said that, did he?
No. So Mike just alluded to that the bard precedes the warrior, but that complete line came into my mind. And I've no idea where it came from. I thought maybe I'd heard it before, so I googled it online, or use a search engine online, probably not Google. And that mantra's been floating around in my mind ever since. So when you think about it, really, the Bard is the heart and the soul of his people. Yeah. I mean, he's essentially the folk's life in song, and also a beacon to guide them as well. And the Bard not only brings people together in a physical sense through both song and story, but the music also brings about a sense of completion in a spiritual sense. So I see a great significance to the Bard. And yeah. I think you did a post on this as well, where you were talking about an old English word surrounding how stories essentially shape our reality.
Yes, I thought
that was a brilliant post. That's the one. Yeah,
yes, yeah. The word shop, the old English, basically the old English equivalent of skald or bard, is shop. And I mean, this is somewhat argued as to the etymological origins of shop and whether it actually relates to the word shape. And our friend Enweird has talked about this as well. But a book I came across did suggest that shop is related to the word shape, and therefore that the shop, the skald or the bard, their role is to shape reality for their folk. And that obviously very much ties in with what you've just said. And I do see it that way. I think that the bard or the shop is the thought, and the warrior is the action. It is symbiotic as well, and the two feed off of one another. I think that's an excellent observation.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I mean, the power of mythology and narrative itself, as we've been saying, is just so powerful. And I think often it can be underestimated. And I think living inside of a mythology or a mythological framework allows you to orientate yourself within the world. And it can be seen as well that, particular groups, can be seen as operating as some kind of vast conspiracy, whereas really it's more likely that they're actually inside a shared narrative and yeah. they're adhering to these, particular archetypal patterns and these mythological and mystical constructs, which essentially guide them through a grand narrative.
Yeah, I think as a dissident movement, we've been somewhat kind of hoodwinked by these centrists, these kind of Jordan Peterson, Ben Shapiro types. You know, that they for the last few years they've been pushing this mantra that, you know, facts don't care about your feelings, and many of us kind of we internalized that, and we took that for granted. We this idea that what matters is facts. No, people's feelings and their subjective view of the world doesn't matter. There is an objective reality. There are facts. That's what matters. Actually, what I'm myself am certainly realizing more and more is that that's completely untrue. Facts don't have nearly as much power as a subjective narrative, as a folk narrative does, or indeed as much power as emotions do, because emotions are what compels men to do great things. Facts don't. And you know, you just mentioned about this idea of this kind of conspiratorial cabal who are, you know, plotting tyranny and things. Well, you know, we tend to have this view that we the good people of the world, we live in this factual objective reality, and co-conspirators are living in a kind of different world where they're trying to enslave us. Actually, all of us are living in our own narratives, and all that matters is whose narrative is stronger. It doesn't, you know, there is really no such thing as truth, except for natural order, you know, physics, the basics of reality. That's the only law that there really is. Anything beyond that, anything created by humans above that, and this includes science, religion, art, everything. All of that is subjective, and it's whose subjective narrative is strongest that matters.
Exactly. Yeah, I'd very much agree with that. And I think, you know, by creating our own narrative or digging into our ancestral narratives, we can create something more beautiful than their narrative, and hopefully succeed in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so should we? I'm gonna feel really kind of self-conscious throughout this episode, but I do think that there's some really good stuff to get into surrounding the story. And I will say at this point as well that I really do feel like the story, as well as much of the music that I've written, has kind of come through me. And I know that kind of sounds like a somewhat kind of cliche, pretentious thing to say, but I do think it's the case. I don't really lay ownership to most of the ideas, or even any of the ideas of this story. So I'm not trying to take credit for any of this, really. It's just something that kind of came through me that I put out there for the folk, particularly for the Northwest European folk, but for the wider kind of European folk, and indeed anyone in the world can hopefully enjoy this story and get something out of it and see something of themselves and their own folk within it. But did you want to get started with the story, perhaps with the name of it, or something else that you'd like to begin with?
Yeah, sure. I mean, let's begin with the title. But as you were saying there, that you felt that the story was very much coming through you. So while I was doing my analysis of the story, it was almost operating as a form of fractal pattern, that the more I began to look into it, the more I was seeing. And I was thinking, was he conscious about putting all of these symbols in here? It was just so rich with symbolism. But yeah, I would very much echo that sentiment. So yeah, the title. So I don't know if you're aware of this, but historically, the white stone was cast as the sign of innocence in a court situation when someone was being judged. So votes for innocence or guilt would be cast using a black stone for guilt and then a white stone for innocence. And if the person was found to be innocent, they would be given a white stone essentially as a symbolic token of their innocence. So this association between the white stone and judgment, I found this to be particularly interesting, especially considering your recent revelations concerning the issue of translation of the Old Norse proverb about what is it? Cattle die, kinsmen die, you too will die, whatever the rest of that is. But yeah, you mentioned that that one of the words had potentially been mistranslated then. It was actually potentially alluding to judgment.
Yes, this was in the last episode of the podcast, but the one prior to this one, number 31, where I spoke with Mark Perrier of the Norowena Society. And this is something he brought to my attention, the famous verse from Havamal, cattle die, kinsmen die, one thing that that does not die or that lives on. There are various translations. Is the reputation of a man. And what Mark enlightened me to is the fact that reputation is actually a mistranslation, and that it's the Old Norse word used is, I think it's something like dalma. Either way, it relates to the English word doom. And one's doom is more to do with judgment. So it's actually the judgment of a man which does not die. So the verse actually, rather than saying that when you die, all that happens is that your name lives on in reputation, in song, is that actually what lives on is your deeds, the worth of your deeds, is your in the sense that you are judged as per your afterlife destination. So it's very much related to where we go upon death. And that is something that does not die. The worth of the way that you lived your life is something that does not die and is something that determines where you go afterwards. So it's an important distinction, that.
Sure. So further into the title, so as you know, I've been conducting an investigation into the Grail mysteries. It's a topic that I've barely scratched the surface with, as it's incredibly vast. But something that had sparked my interest surrounding this topic was the Northumbrian rune set. Now, it's quite strange that I was drawn to this particular rune set, as I'm a total rune novice. So when I'm talking about the runes here, I'm probably going to do lots of mispronunciations. But yeah, so from my understanding, there's 29 Anglo-Saxon runes, and these were expanded upon with a further additional four runes, which are part of the Northumbrian rune set, bringing the total up to 33.
That's right.
So these four additional runes, as far as I'm aware, are completely unique to the set. And these are the Calc rune, one called, is it Sirwerth?
It's, I believe it's pronounced Calch, although Calch. I'm not entirely sure. It could be Calc or it could be Calch. And it's Quaoth.
Quaoth, sure. And then there's Stan and Gar.
Yeah. 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 And these are typically referred to as the Four Hallows, or sometimes as the Grail runes, or certainly three of them are. And I'm glad that you brought that up at this point, because this is one of the starting points of Fire and the White Stone. This is one of the foundational ideas of the story. When I came across the esoteric significance of these four runes, and the fact that they are unique to the British Isles. I mean, there are some theories about them being related to like Alanic Roman mercenaries who may have influenced the Germanic runes and introduced these ideas, or perhaps they came from the West and they're actually a Celtic influence or something like that. But nevertheless, we do find in the Anglo-Northumbrian, or the Frisian Northumbrian, because I believe that they are also shared with the Frisian attestations as well. But they are unique to the Ingvaeonic Northwestern European rune set. And as you said, Quaoth is often interpreted as sword, and Calc or Calch is chalice, and Stan is stone, and Gar is spear. So there we have a set of runes which is strongly, inextricably related to the Grail mythos. And really, this was the foundation of the story. And also, what you mentioned about the white stones in the courtroom, I wasn't aware of that. But I was aware that the white stone has been associated with religion for a long time, with religious piety and devotion for a long time. And I came across some interesting articles about Irish priests who would carry white stones in their pocket and drop them around the grounds of their church and things like this. So there has always been this association between spirituality and the white stone. And this is another thing which informed the title and indeed the theme of the story.
Sure. So the Calc rune, as well as being a cup or a chalice, is also the origin of the word chalk.
Yeah.
Now, if you type in chalk and England into a search engine, one of the first images that will come up will be that of the Uffington White Horse, an image that I included in my short video, Living Mythology, The Horse Without a Rider, which I think it was one of the videos that initially sparked your interest in some of the content that I was creating.
Yes, yeah.
So there's as you mentioned, these are referred to as the Grail runes sometimes, and the White Stone as well. In Wolfram von Eschenbach's Parsifal, the Grail is actually described as a white stone, which I think is both an alchemical reference, but also pertains to something within the Gnostic mysteries as well. And so as well as being associated with the chalice, a white stone, the Gnostic mysteries as well, and the white horse, it's also the word calc also draws some of my mind to Calci, which even sounds, you know, like calc. And so Calci is the 10th avatar of Vishnu, who rides a white horse and is said to bring about the end of Kali Yuga.
No, yeah, you're spot on with all of this. And most of this was stuff that I was conscious of when I started. I wasn't aware of anyone else who'd made the connection between the Calc or Calch rune and the white stone. It's, as I say, you know, runologists and heathens and you know, kind of the more esoterically minded have for a fairly long time connected Calch with chalice. That's been quite readily accepted, but very few people have pointed out how kalch means chalk. And when I looked into it, I found that in Old England, chalk didn't actually refer to a specific type of mineral, a specific type of stone. You know, what we know today as chalk, the thing that you write on blackboards with, it actually referred to any type of white stone could be called chalk. So this was really the real kind of core of the foundation of the idea for the whole story, was this idea of the chalice itself being the white stone, and obviously being part of the Grail runes, tying in with the Grail mythos and the just the hero's journey concept in general. And this was really the birth of you know, my concept with this story.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't aware of this at all, and it's certainly quite strange that you know, as I, myself, I'm a complete rune novice, that I, you know, was drawn to this particular rune set and these four runes in particular, which, you know, seem to be the basis for the crafting this narrative. So yeah, that's certainly a great deal of synchronicity involving that.
Right, so I mean, yeah, you know, Fire in the White Stone. I mean, I needed to kind of think of a catchy title for the book, and yeah, the fire aspect of it, I suppose that came from that this is related to the idea of the Ingrun, really, and this is, you know, some of the work of my friend Wolf Ingersunu has done. And connecting Ing with Agni, the Vedic god of fire, because if you take the word Inga backwards, it's Agni. So there is this relation between Ing and fire, and obviously we have in modern English, we have the Ingelnook fire, the Ingelnook fire. So there does seem to be a connection between the English or Germanic god Ing or Ingvi Frey, and the concept of fire. And the Ingrun is found within the or is kind of found as part of the kalch, or one form of the kalch rune appears as like an Ingrun. So I was kind of trying to make these sorts of connections, and you know, this was the idea that this is the kind of ultimate prize of the white stone chalice, is the fire, the energy that it can exude when activated. So that's where the title came. And, you know, obviously I had to think of quite a kind of catchy, striking name for the album title and the book. So, yeah, I mean, I don't really know what more I have to say about the name, unless there's anything else that you kind of thought to bring up.
Yeah, so there's another one of those four runes. I believe it pertains to fire as well, but I think it maybe means the flames of a fire. But this is differentiated from the fire rune in that it represents the process of transformation through fire and a form of cleansing by fire itself. So I thought when I was initially kind of putting this together that you know, perhaps I was really clutching at straws here, that well, that was until I opened my vinyl copy of Fire in the White Stone and I saw that the kalch rune there with the flames pouring out of it. So we have literally fire in the white stone.
Yeah absolutely. And that kind of, I guess the title kind of gives away the story in a sense, but but well, you need to go on the journey to get there to kind of make sense of it in the first place. So,
totally, yeah. And another thing as well is I was really impressed with this beautifully rendered map that you included with the book as well. And I'm a big fan of maps in books, and I was someone who would pore over fantasy maps and, you know, plot where the Fellowship were traveling in the Lord of the Rings, and I would draw maps in the back of my maths book at school. So yeah, I mean, this is an absolutely beautiful map. And as I was reading the story, I was referring to the map to, you know, see where our central protagonist was, and I noticed that it appeared that the psychological state of the character as they progressed around the map was, it was almost a psychic journey of sorts. While it was physical geography, it was almost a form of psycho geography, so to speak, as the journey that that Nook goes through is both a journey in the physical space, but also in the terrain of the psyche. So I thought it was interesting to note those psychological states he was going through as he was traversing the map. I mean, we obviously start off in Modusley, and Moda is it means mother in Proto-Germanic, and Lee refers to an open field or a meadow. So it's in Old English. So that's just literally mother's field, which is his, you know, his home, his kind of safe haven, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm impressed that you picked up on that. Yeah. That was intentional. And I think at this point it's worth mentioning the kind of other kind of foundational aspect of this story, and the kind of process that occurs within it. And this draws upon the Alu runic formula, which is something that I have spoken about a bit on the podcast and several times on the Telegram channel. So for those of you who don't know, I'll give a very brief introduction to this. In England and I believe Sweden, there have been several bractites and funerary urns, which have and also some coins, which have the three runes Ansus, Lagus, and Urus inscribed upon them. And this has kind of confused academics for a long time. And, you know, to this point where the accepted consensus for this is that Alu simply means ale, and that this is the only significance of these three runes being together. This never made sense to me. And when I, you know, again, this is inspired and helped along by the work of my friend Wolf Ingersunu, who's written on this. But also I've done quite a bit with this myself, where Stephen McNallan of the Ars Atru Folk Assembly wrote a short book several years ago. I think it was probably about 10 years ago. Maybe a little bit less, 8 or 9 years ago, called A Method of Transcendence in, I can't remember the entire title, in the Germanic religion or something like this. And what he had discovered, or I believe it was Stephen that discovered this, was that in Irish law, there are three cauldrons. Now, I forget the name of them, unfortunately, but he likened or compared these three cauldrons to three of the main chakras in the human body, one of them being at the base of the spine, one being roughly at the solar plexus, and then one being at the crown of the head. And you at the base of the spine, you have a cauldron. I think it's called Boden, and it's an upside down black cauldron. And then at the solar plexus, you have one, and I forget the name. I apologize. A red cauldron on its side, and then at the crown, you have a white cauldron. Which is, you know, facing the correct way, you know, holding what it's meant to contain. So you have the three sacred colors of the Indo-Europeans there, red, white, and black. And these are corresponding with the three chakras. I wondered if the Alu runes, Ansus, Lagus, and Urus, could be put in the place of these three runes. Stephen McNallan had chosen three different runes. I believe he'd had Raido rune for the solar plexus. I think he may have, I forget which runes he had at the other points, but I positioned the Alu runes at these points. So Urus for the base of the spine, Lagus for the solar plexus or the heart, and Ansus for the crown. Now you have Urus is the rune of origin, or, you know, primeval origin. And then Lagus is the rune of the kind of flow of energy, I believe, or the you know, it on a less kind of symbolic level, it means water. It relates to the word lake, for example. So you know, you have for the heart, which obviously the heart pumps the sacred liquid we call blood around the body, and then you have Ansus, which is the rune of the god. the gods and communication, and is the rune that is most often associated with the Allfather, Odin, at the crown. So for me, I developed this idea that the Alu runic formula is actually one of almost like a kind of alchemical spiritual process. And that you actually find on many of these bractates and funerary urns that the runes are the other way round, or that they're sometimes mirrored. So you have Alu Ula. So those of you who follow the Fergon on Telegram will notice that these runes are next to the name in the title of the channel. So this story, Fire in the White Stone, I actually structured it according to this alchemical process, Ula. So you have this point of origin, and as Adam just mentioned, you have the town of Modersley, the Mother's Lee, Mother's Clearing, where the main protagonist starts his journey. There are also some other hints at this kind of point of origin in the story, which we'll get to shortly. So the story is divided up into three sections, essentially. There's the section of Uruz, where the character is kind of still very much embroiled in his origins. He's still tied to his kind of his mundane existence. And then you have the period of change represented by Lagus. And then you have the period of kind of spiritual attainment at the end of the story, which is represented by Answers. So sorry that wasn't quite as brief as I hoped it would be. But yeah, I hope that kind of complements what Adam was saying there about the name of the town.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I was completely unaware that there was a conception of the chakra energy system within Germanic paganism. So that's, and also that you structured the story in this way as well. I could certainly pick up on a lot of alchemical language used throughout, even though I wasn't aware of that formulation that you had.
Yeah, well, it is a bit UPG. There is some unverified personal gnosis there. There's no, we've got nothing to suggest that the ancient Germanics used the Alu formula in this way. I believe that it's possible that this is what the Alu runic formula is and has always meant. But this is speculation. We don't have any proof of that. So it's a modern interpretation of a very ancient runic formula.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm all about the UPG. I'm literally the, source. I made it up guy. So, but yeah, back to the map, and so we've also got the West Wolds as well. Wolds referring to rolling hills or uplands, and the old English word referring to a forest. And as well as that, we have the Rhyme Land, which I guess this kind of refers to the rim or the edge, some kind of geographical feature. And also I kind of saw it as being, as I mentioned about this being a psychic journey as well, as of the essentially the main character being taken to his threshold or to the edge, between two worlds essentially. And also I loved the, that phonetically Rhymeland just makes you think of the word rhyme, which just further plays with the lyrical quality that's found throughout the book. Yeah. And lastly, you have Gar's Edge as well, which is from the Old English, which refers to a spear, and also that references the Gar rune as well that I mentioned earlier.
Yeah. So yeah, there's quite a lot here. Firstly, it wasn't really very conscious the way that the geography of the story does actually reflect the kind of psychology of the journey, but it does. Yeah, I mean, it's almost quite childlike the way it happens, where the main character kind of, he goes off into the woods, into the wilds, the kind of, it goes into the unknown essentially there, and he does then get washed, or he finds himself washed away by the river. This is the Lagus period of the story, the period of change. And yes, he does end up at the fringes of the land, the Rhyme Land. And in this sense, rhyme refers to frost, rhyme as in ice. So it is the land of ice. This is really related to the idea of the Hrimthurs, the ice giants of Nordic mythology. And it is essentially a Hrimthurs or Hrimthurs that Nook does encounter at the end of the story. So that's why that land is the Rhymeland, why it is the land of ice and snow. It also is that because I worked a very vivid dream that I had, which I believe was a divine encounter about some swans. And I won't go into that yet, but the dream I had featuring these two giant swans took place in a land of ice and frost. So all of these kind of things kind of coalesced to create the geography of the land. And I'm very glad that you noticed that.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll be touching on swans later on, no doubt. But yeah, I mean, so we crack on into chapter one after we've finished admiring the map. First character that's named is this character of Farmer Borrell, and now I absolutely love this name. I mean, it's really, really evocative, and you get the impression of what the character looks like even before you give any description. And the name just straight away just sounds like barrel, so I immediately pictured him as some fairly rotund and stocky man with a barrel chest and a large frame, as you describe later on. And there's also in the historical English dictionary, there's the word Borrell, which is used as an adjective for a comely man or a peasant or countryman.
Right, I wasn't aware of that. I just tried to come up with the most kind of earthy name that I possibly could.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, we're certainly going to be touching on the earthy themes of the opening of the novel as well. And also, Borrell refers to a coarse cloth as well, derived from the Dutch word boren. I believe that's okay. How it's pronounced. Maybe not. But so there's perhaps a connection here, considering how Farmer Borrell becomes the source of Nook's. When I was reading the book, I was saying Nook, but it's actually Nook. But until I heard your version, your audiobook version, yeah, he acquires his protective cloak from Farmer Borrell.
I'm going to jump in here because there's quite an important bit of deliberate symbolism in the bull who dies to become the leather cloak which Nook wears for his journey. The beginning of the story kind of it centers around Nook essentially hanging around Farmer Borrell's field, admiring Farmer Borrell's his ox, which obviously relates to the ancient Auroch. And Auroch is the given interpretation of the rune Uras. So we have the Ura's rune, which means, you know, primal origins, but it also means the Auroch, the Uroks even. So there's this, you know, as I said, the story is structured in Ura's, Lagu's answers. So this is very much the beginning of the Ura's section of the story. And so I wanted to work this idea of the Auroch or the ox into it. And we have this ancient, you know, ox bull who Nook is quite fond of, but is very old. And Nook is aware that when the ox dies, then he's hoping to be able to turn that ox into a leather cloak, you know, to make use of. So, the bull very much kind of symbolizes the origin of Nook and the stagnation of Nook's life within Modersley. So yeah, that's about that.
I thought it was nice that Furrows, the name of the bull or the ox, was named by Nook sorry, on essentially based on a kind of backstory that he kind of speculates. He kind of infers it from the various different battle scars, and he ponders how the bull must have been involved in many prior battles before Farmer Borrell secured him, or wrestled the bull and then returned him back to Modersley.
Yeah, this ties into the ancient Germanic concept of young men proving themselves by wrestling aurochs. And this is tied to the meaning of the rune. So this is just a little idea that I wanted to work in there, that Farmer Borrell, although he is now kind of this somewhat sort of slovenly, barrel-shaped man who can't really be bothered with anything other than drinking ale, that at one time he was actually a very virile young man. And this is kind of symbolic of the town in general. The town of Modersley and the people that Nook comes from, they were once a great people full of these very virile traditions, and they've kind of let themselves go. And for this reason, Nook has become disillusioned with them.
Yeah, you can certainly see how this, how Farmer Borrell domesticated Furrows, and that this domestication process is actually a two-way process. And as Borrell is, he's as much domesticated by Furrows as Furrows is domesticated by the farmer here.
Yeah, good observation. Yeah, I agree.
And so, in an astrological sense, I mean, because that's what I initially kind of picked up. As soon as you have a bull in a field, I'm going to think of Taurus. And so Taurus is associated with qualities of stability, security, and material comfort. And you mentioned naming Borrell to have him the most, you wanted the most earthy name possible. But so Taurus is associated with the earth element, and it's a fixed sign there. And right. And earth within alchemy is considered to be it's a process within alchemy which is used in the passive stage, in which the embodiment of the spirit that comes into materialization.
Right. Yeah.
So I would very much see the kind of death of the bull here as the kind of, at least for Nook, this is the end of stability and security and material comfort. And I found it very interesting as well, because you named the chapter Foreboding, and Nook is sat on the fence, and he's waiting for six long nights sat on the fence, essentially waiting for the bull to die. It's like he had a premonition of this occurring.
Yeah, the phrase is one wide moon and six long nights, and there is a significance to that, but I can't actually remember what it is. There will be a couple of things like that, which I can't actually remember why I wrote them into it, but I did have a reason at the time. But yeah, I suppose it was never really intentional that it was meant to be a premonition as such. It was more just that Nook had nothing better to look forward to. And it's not that he was looking forward to the death of the bull. It's just that he knew that the bull was on its last legs, as fond of it as he was, of Furrows as he was. So it was an event, and it was something which only he cared about. And consciously, there's not really anything more to it than that. But it may be the case that there are things which I didn't do deliberately, which are there, symbols which are kind of accidental.
Sure. Well, I mean, you would say, well, accidental or kind of channeled through you as you were kind of writing this. Yeah. You also mentioned six a little bit later on when Nook is drinking with Farmer Borrell. I think you say an ale or six. The six long nights six. Is represents harmony and balance. I know that six tends to get a bad name in certain traditions, but six holds the, it's essentially about the, is related to the archetypal maternal instincts as well, which links with the name of the town, which is, you know, Modusley, meaning Mother's Field, and also that kind of the stability and security that that the bull represents in that sense. And the six as well, for me, linked with, as you name the chapter, foreboding, it links with, I guess, the sixth sense of extrasensory perception. So I imagine it wasn't arbitrary in its selection there. And as well, you mentioned that Nook is sat on the fence, you know, watching the bull in the field, and being sat on the fence, it kind of made me think of, he's essentially between spaces. He's kind of between realms, really. He's on the dividing line of the town, which kind of represents his kind of relationship with the town and the townsfolk as well, who he's become distant from, in a sense. So
that wasn't conscious, but yeah, that's interesting. That, I mean, I suppose Nook is undecided, really. He's the only citizen of the town who isn't just kind of blindly content with life as it is. And I suppose his sitting on the fence is sort of symbolic of that, really.
Sure. And as well, the name of the bull, Furrows. So when I first read that, for some reason, I began thinking about the Slavic pagan tradition. And from what I understand, rather than having the concept of the Wheel of Time, they actually have the Plow of Time, which is a much more kind of like brutal and suitably Slavic conception of a similar idea. And I first learned about this through a track by a band called Drudka. They have a track called Furrow of the Gods. Drudka are a Ukrainian black metal band, and it's on their album Blood in the Wells, which is heavily steeped in Slavic mythology, and all the lyrics are from their various different national poets. So then we've got Nook's wife, Marin. So from what I understand, that's from a Danish word. It means to tell or to narrate or to recite. And yeah, so I wasn't sure if you intended that or if it was just a particularly kind of beautiful name.
It wasn't. With the names of the places, it was. I wanted to strike a balance between not using any historical real names, but at the same time, I wanted the names to evoke Old England, or certainly kind of Northwestern Europe, at least, because that's the spirit of the story, really. You know, all of the it draws upon Northwest European lore for its kind of foundations. So I wanted the names to be at least evocative of this part of the world. But the name Marin didn't have any intent behind it whatsoever. It's just a name that I came up with, which wasn't a real name that I know of, but was, but still kind of evoked that feeling of Old England.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful name. So in terms of Nook's relationship, I really liked the way that you presented this. He hasn't fallen out of love with his wife at all, but he's becoming frustrated by the general lack of questioning, both from his wife and also the townsfolk as well. And as you mentioned, the once great town has now grown stagnant, and this is kind of reflected in his relationship with his wife, who's now become content, and she's happy with the social equilibrium that she finds within her current role. But there's a sense of a loss of grace, perhaps, there.
Yeah, Marin and their relationship is meant to be a very immediate, simple representation of Nook's discontentment with the town. And it's not, as with Maron, his wife, it's not that he's fallen out of love with her, nor has he fallen out of love with the town. You know, indeed, he never seeks to abandon the town completely, but he just feels that it has fallen from grace. It has kind of abandoned its past greatness, beauty, principles, sense of wonder, of mysticism, of justice. You know, and this is represented in the, you know, it's mentioned early on that the king has, you know, agents who come and collect taxes. There are references to usury. There are references to, I use the term vain little follies or something like that. You know, small castles which the taxes are used to repair around the land. Basically, it's meant to create an understanding that the town and the people of this town are basically under the heel of a certain greed above them, and that the reason that they are under that heel is because they have forgotten what made them great in the first place. They've forgotten the traditions and the virility of the folk, which enabled them to kind of stave off those kind of predatory practices to begin with. And it's one of the reasons that Nook is disillusioned by the town. And, you know, I mean, this has direct correlations with our modern situation in our modern world. It is meant to be a representation of what we're going through, but on probably a far more horrific scale in the modern times, with the amount of predatory usury that we suffer on a day-to-day basis. And it was, even though it was on a much smaller scale for Nook and the people of Modersley, I tried to make it clear that it's still not just, and it's still not okay, and it's still something that should be sought, that people should seek to overcome.
Yeah, exactly. And Nook here seems to be the only one asking questions about this. So he feels he has to venture forth, and I guess he kind of almost occupies the almost a shamanic role, in that he goes out into the unknown. You know, that the shaman would kind of enter into altered states and the unknown realm, and then bring back something of value for his folk. And I suppose that Nook is doing a similar thing here.
Yeah, definitely. And that's the basis of the hero's journey, isn't it?
Totally. Yeah, so in terms of the timing of this as well, I noticed that you mentioned that this is the end of November. So in an astrological sense, this places us squarely in Sagittarius, which is the centaur, or the sometimes depicted as an archer as well. And this is the it's a mutable fire sign and the ninth sign of the zodiac. And you referenced nine later at the end of the story. And so it's ruled by Jupiter, which is associated with expansion. And in Eastern astrology, Jupiter is very much seen as being the guru or the teacher planet. And Sagittarius is all about truth seeking and finding answers. And it indicates that the best way to do this is through travel. So it seems very fitting that this was the time in which Nook decided to go on his journey.
I wasn't aware of any of that, and this is exactly why you're the right person to get on for this episode to talk about this, because your knowledge of astrology and of these kind of symbols that's where my knowledge is lacking. And I mean, I have to confess at this point that my birthday is in November. That isn't the reason that I set the story here, though. It was purely coincidence, really. I mean, the reason that I set it in November is because that's the time of the year where there is a change going on, where times become darker. So in terms of Nook's journey, he's about to go into a dark place. So it was just a very kind of simple reflection of that, really. But I had no idea about I really know very little about astrology, despite having spoken to Fiona Adgar for one of the podcast episodes and, you know, intending to look more into it. But I know very little about it, so I didn't know any of the significance of Sagittarius or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, Fiona's a fantastic heathen astrologer, certainly much more learned in astrology to me. I just have a very kind of broad kind of macro understanding. And that episode was great, by the way. A couple of friends went on to get readings from Fiona after that.
Oh, brilliant. That's good to hear.
Another thing as well, we've got the Farmer Borrell tells Nook about the second sun that used to be present in Modestly. And he kind of laughs this off as that it was some kind of fantasy, but it's kind of indicated that perhaps he doesn't think this story is nonsense. So what were you referring to here by this second sun? And why does Farmer Borrell bring this up?
Well, firstly, I think it was a device that I used to demonstrate the fact that the people of Modersley had forgotten some of the more mystical aspects of their past. You know, just some very simple, almost unexplained mythology from the past, from the collective folk of the town, had been forgotten on a very, very surface level. I just wanted to express this idea that the town had forgotten some of their mythology. But there's also the idea of we have in certain esoteric heathen circles, we have the idea of the black sun. Now, this is used quite often as a political symbol, you know, in the same way that the swastika is. But those who look at it from a more spiritual esoteric angle, there's a vast depth to the concept of the black sun. It's the idea of a hidden creative force. So the way I interpret it, and, you know, there are various interpretations of this, but my interpretation and understanding of the concept of the black sun is that we have this kind of dualistic counterpart. We have the material sun, the sun that we all see, which gives all material things their life and sustains them. But what animates and sustains the kind of the hidden, the spirit of all things, you know, from an animistic point of view, everything is animated with spirit. What sustains the spirit of things rather than the body of things? And this, in my estimations, is the black sun. It's the hidden spiritual life force. So this is what the second sun refers to, really, is that the people of Modersley once had an understanding of this hidden spiritual life force that they now no longer have, and now that they're entirely materialist.
Sure, I thought you might have been alluding to the black sun there. Something else I noticed as well is that Borrell associates the second sun with the bringing of fertility to the land, which made me think of the medievalist and folklorist Jesse L. Weston, who wrote From Ritual to Romance in the 1920s. So she was a scholar of the Arthurian legends and the Holy Grail, drawing up on the work of James Frazer, who wrote The Golden Bough. And she made all of these connections between the Grail mysteries and to ancient fertility rites and rituals to bring back life to the land to ensure the growth of crops. And these rituals potentially coming from the folklore that goes back even as far as the Bronze Age.
Right. I've not heard of that author, but yeah, that's very interesting. There is another aspect of the second sun idea, which is this idea of each age of man being represented by a new sun. Yeah, and you do have some people who believe that when we have a solar eclipse, for example, that actually, you know, and some people believe literally that there is a new sun being born. That's a bit far out for me, but we can say that spiritually there is perhaps a new sun emerging and a new chief deity, perhaps. You know, we could say, you know, I mean, when we talk about Christ being, you know, the Son of God, if you take that word literally, being the sun, and then being replaced by another deity in another epoch as another. So it's also this idea that a new sun or a second sun brings fertility because it rejuvenates the land because it's fresh, it's new. There's a new, there's a new life bringer in the cosmos.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we could certainly do with a new sun as we're, approaching the, well, depends on, chronology really, but I suppose the end of the kind of Piscean age and going into the age of Aquarius, and the sun will be in Aquarius at that point.
Yeah, indeed.
I mean, the Pisces is, I guess, the kind of epistemic breaking point, or the kind of extremes of Pisces, is essentially peak narcissism, which seems to be running rampant, I would say, at the moment.
Yeah, very much so.
And so I mentioned as well that Nook is the only one in the town who's asking questions, and now anyone who's familiar with the Grail Mysteries will also know that that's essentially a mythological theme throughout those stories. In John Boorman's Excalibur, anyone who's watched that will know the answer to the question, "What is the secret of the Grail?" And the answer to that is that you and the land are one. And in that instance, the "you" is referring to King Arthur, who, through some creative liberties in the film, is combined with the wounded Fisher King character. So this is the part in the film where Arthur is sick, and the land reflects the health of the king. So it's a dying wasteland at this point. But when Arthur drinks from the Grail, his health is restored, and you have this incredible sequence. I really love the sequence where all the life is being restored to the land. So yeah, we can see this mythological theme of asking questions, in particular asking the right questions. So yeah, I can see that Nook is frustrated with the lack of questioning from both the townsfolk and his wife, and it's this kind of lack of questioning which, and Nook being the one who asks questions, as setting him off on his quest.
Yeah, and I'm not going to claim that that was conscious. I am a huge fan of Boorman's Excalibur. I mean, it's one of my favorite films of all time. I'm actually beyond that. I'm actually not that knowledgeable about the Grail mythos. I've still not read Parsifal, for example, although it's high up on my list of books to read. So I do. I would say that my Arthurian inspiration does come heavily from that film, but from what I understand, it is quite faithful to the mythology. There are a couple of liberties that Boorman took, but for the most part, it does seem to be quite faithful from what I hear. I didn't The idea of Nook asking questions wasn't a conscious allusion to that, but I think that it's just I mean, it's a very simple thing to say, but you can only make change if you first ask questions. And whether those questions be from someone else or of yourself, what you need to be asking questions, you need to be analyzing things and asking why things are the way they are or why they're not the way that you think that they should be. So questions are a very powerful thing, and I think that is something, an eternal truth which is presented in the Grail mythos, particularly through Parsifal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I would say that Boorman's rendition of the Grail saga is very faithful, despite his creative liberties, which I feel that he kind of adds to the story in a sense, and he also draws upon its pre-Christian influences as well, which I feel is a much more true telling of the Grail story. It often gets kind of conflated with Christian mythos of that it's the cup that Christ used at the Last Supper, but so I think this is just typical Christianization of our mythologies, really.
Yeah, definitely. So I think in your notes, you're at this point, you'd move on to chapter two, Lorne and Loathe. And also, I should mention as well that the chapters in the book do correspond to the songs on the album. The songs on the album by my project Walkensman, they are intended to evoke the mood of what happens in those chapters in terms of the story. So it was an exercise in score composition, really, but a score which is in song form. So there are vocals, there are verses and choruses, and it's not just kind of background music. It is foreground music, but in certain moods which are sympathetic to what's happening in the story. And the song "Lorn and Loathe" is a very kind of melancholic song, which ends up being quite rousing, I suppose. So, and that's pretty much what happens in during the course of this chapter of the book. Yeah, Lorn and Loathe. What do you want to talk about with that one then, Adam?
Sure, yeah. I mean, the song Lorn and Loathe is beautiful, and it certainly reflects the kind of slightly kind of melancholic aspects of the chapter, in a sense. And it's also the acknowledgement by Nook that his fate lies elsewhere. And I think that's wonderfully conveyed through the song. So I'd actually listened to the album quite a few times before I even discovered that there was a tie-in novel with this. But yeah, so he leaves the town and he's holding his torch in his hands, and he sees the fireflies dancing around the glow of his torch. And this makes him think about Maren and how he wished that she would dance freely like the fireflies around this glowing light. And you kind of bookend this concept in the final chapter of the book when Nook returns from his quest. And another element I found really interesting is that Nook leaves without any weapons at all. And that, you know, this quest into the unknown without a weapon, this indicates to me that this is more of it's not a test of might, but instead a test of the mind. I mean, all he takes with him is a small flask of water and some coins, you know, jangling around. And of course, his leather cloak as well, which is his link with the town and material comfort of the life that he's leaving behind.
Yeah, that's purely because he's aimless. He doesn't know where he's going. He has no intention to go anywhere particular. He just knows that he needs to go somewhere. So that's, you know, if I'd endowed him with a weapon, then that would imply that he has some kind of plan, that he has something that he's targeting, that he's going. And also, you know, this is a man who, he's not a warrior at all. He never has been. You know, the town is not martial anymore. The folk are not martial. They're not raised in to understand martial combat in the same way that we're not in our modern times. And that I see that as another way that we have degenerated as a society, because although peace should always be the goal, peace and freedom can only be truly preserved when there is a strong warrior prowess within a folk. So it was just another way of expressing the fact that Nook comes from a degenerated society, and that he is not a complete man. He's only partly a man, really, and he doesn't have any martial prowess himself. He doesn't have any understanding of violence or how to dish it out, or how to defend from it, or anything like that. So that's really the reason that he leaves town unarmed.
Yeah, well, thankfully he has some friends that he encounters later on who can provide him with a weapon when he needs it most. As I mentioned, with the bull furrows being associated with earth symbolism within the first chapter, obviously referring to the stability and comfort, in chapter two we get a strong emphasis on the wind. There's all of these whooshing sounds, there's the wind howling, there's the trees being blown around. So the focus here, rather than being on earth, is now moved to air, which is another alchemical symbol. And air is actually the opposite of earth. So we kind of flip in terms of the elements there at that point. And the air symbol is an upward facing triangle with a line through the top. So air is the element of the of intelligence, of the mind, but it also is about new beginnings as well. And you can also about the destructive and maybe chaotic aspect of wind and air as well. And it's that kind of reflects this runaway mind and the mind that can't be silenced. And we kind of see this with Nuke at this stage, where his mind is racing and he's questioning whether he should continue with his quest. He's kind of wrestling between things like desire and duty. He's wondering maybe if he should go back, if he's just treading a path that's been trod by others many times before. And it's really kind of a somewhat of a mental conflict at this point.
Yeah, that it's not the air thing isn't conscious, but it's you're so good, Adam, at making these connections where others wouldn't have done. So I'm very grateful for that. And I guess, I mean, the obvious thing to say is that air equates to movement, whereas earth equates to stagnation. So it does mark that change between the stagnation of Modersley in the hometown of the mother's clearing, you know, where Nook comes from. And the movement into this new region, both geographically and psychologically, that Nook is participating in. So, yeah, it wasn't conscious, but I mean this is what's amazing about this is, as I said, you know, near the beginning, I'm not taking credit for this because I really do feel that these things came through me, and I think that anyone can do this. I think that with just a basic understanding of some of these occult esoteric symbols and principles and Indo-European customs and law and tradition, you can just start putting something together and find that it almost starts to create itself, and the connections start to create themselves, and the symbols start to intertwine in this kind of magical way. And it's not something necessarily that the author should take credit for. It's just the folk soul is speaking through us when we do things like this, whether it be through the magic of music or through poetry or, you know, visual art or video editing, you know, as Adam does, or, you know, there are so many ways that these principles can channel through us. And I just feel very grateful that these ideas were able to come through me because, I do feel like I played a part. But anyway, this isn't, I'm trying not to make this about me because I really don't feel like it is. I want to appraise this story from a very detached perspective as much as I can. And I thank Adam for helping me to do that. But yeah, the air symbolism wasn't conscious, but it is potent.
Well, you're a fantastic vessel in bringing forth this novel. So congratulations with that. And yeah, so you also mentioned as well a green glow, and so the color green is you mentioned before about the heart chakra. So green in traditionally within the Vedic system is associated with the heart chakra, and that's also associated with air as well, as its placement within it's within the cardiac system and the lungs. And the symbol of the heart chakra is two interlacing triangles, which symbolizes the power of the spirit and matter coming together. It's also associated with what's called the alchemical wedding, which is the union of the masculine and feminine principles, which is also depicted as the chalice and the blade. And the heart chakra tends to foster self-confidence. And so we can see almost from each step that Nook takes, he's casting aside his doubts and he's listening to his heart. And this comes through with the line where you mentioned the direction that he's traveling in as well. So he's traveling eastward. And now, believe it or not, but east is associated with the element of air. So we have the connection between the green glow, the heart chakra, the lots of wind wind and whooshing and trees blowing around. He's heading eastwards, also associated with the air. And then you have this line, which is his heart pulled onwards, and eastwards, and his mind fought for home.
Yeah. Yeah, none of that was conscious at all. I mean, the only, as far as the color green goes, it's my favorite color. And the reason that it's my favorite color is because green to me has always represented the mystical. I don't know why that is. I have these kind of, I wrote some notes for the first Walkinsman album, Songs from the Fergan. I recorded a bonus EP to go with it called Songs from the Mere. And on there, there's a song called The Green Wall. And this was actually musically, it was the first dark folk song that I ever wrote as a teenager. Well, I think I was probably about 18 or 19, something like that. Perhaps even a little bit younger. But lyrically, it's called The Green Wall because, and I explain this in the notes on that album as well. There's this, I don't know if anyone, this is extremely difficult to explain. And I don't know if anyone will get what I'm saying here, but when you were kind of in those moments between waking conscious and sleep and almost like daydream consciousness and things like that, and you get these fleeting glimpses of another place, a place which feels just incredibly homely and powerful to you. And for me, it's a place, it's a green place, but not like an unnatural green place, but almost if you imagine standing beside a wall of juniper trees or something like that, you know, that kind of this idea of a very dense, natural green wall created by trees or something like that with a very well-groomed, almost kind of carpeted grass ground and things, but these very vivid greens that come off of these things and just the feeling that I get from that. And it's extremely difficult to describe, but that's kind of my ultimate happy place, is to be in that. And it's why I'm so drawn to forests and things like that. But I've always just been very, very drawn to the color green. And for me, it represents the mystical, you know. So when I wrote about there being this kind of a flash of a green glow, it was just meant to say, okay, this is where there is where that green glow is. That's where the journey must go. That's where you're being beckoned to.
Totally. I mean, green certainly has a kind of very mystical quality. So many, I guess, the aurora borealis, you know, that kind of and so I mean, it's interesting how all those things all tie together, even though it wasn't conscious. The green glow, the heart chakra, and the direction of east. I mean, east is also associated with new beginnings, entering a new phase of life. It's obviously where the sun rises, so that's, it kind of reflects a new phase, a new cycle, a new day. And it's also the path of illumination, gaining esoteric knowledge, and also finding your own voice as well. There's the expression East of Eden, which refers to the east is actually the direction that Adam and Eve were when they were expelled from the Garden of Eden after the magic apple curse, after eating from the tree of knowledge. He also at this point as well, I think it's the first time that he hears female voices as well, which we hear, I believe, a further two times in the story, and I wasn't sure if this connected with the part within the hero's journey during the it's in the initiatory phase, which is called the meeting with the goddess. Perhaps you were hinting at that here.
Before I comment on that, I just want to say that the way that you connected all of that to do with East and Green and the heart and things like this, that's, I mean, to me, that's truly impressive. And what Adam is doing in being able to decipher all of this, stuff which I didn't consciously put into the story, that work is just as important as the writing of the story itself, you know, because it, symbolism, the kind of the channeling of symbolism like this means nothing if people aren't able to read it. But thankfully, people like Adam, whether instinctively or through, you know, a lifetime of study, are able to read that symbolism and actually make sense of it in a way which even the author didn't intend or wasn't even aware of. So, you know, this is what I mean by... this is why I was willing, you know, and keen to talk about this story, because it really isn't about the person that wrote it. It's about this collective unconscious coming through the people and being able to be deciphered by the people in the way that Adam is as well. So I really have to thank you for that, Adam, because these are things which I wouldn't have picked up on myself. And I didn't when I wrote it. As for The Voice on the Wind, yeah. This is about the idea of being, of hearing the call of the gods. Now, I believe that I was called by the gods, and not just me, many of us are. And I've had this conversation with a lot of people. You know, someone like, I can only offer the example of myself. I come from an entirely atheistic family. You know, both of my parents, in fact, all of my grandparents were atheists or at least agnostics. None of them were religious, and certainly none of them were even close to interested in paganism or heathenry. In fact, no one in my family was. There's no reason why I went down that path. Also, the more, shall we say, identitarian aspects of my worldview of recognizing the importance of ethnic identity and preservation of ethnic groups. This is something which none of my parents or grandparents share, at least not on an overt level. And in many ways, I've battled with them throughout the years, and I didn't grow up with friends who had any of this. So when I reached the point in my life where this worldview had solidified, I found myself asking, why do I hold these views when no one taught me to hold these views? And the only legitimate answer that I can come up with is that I was taken to that place by the gods. I did heed the call of the gods. And this is what is represented in this aspect of the story, the voice on the wind, the voice. And the reason that they're female voices or seem to be female voices is that these are the three sisters of fate, the three weird sisters, Verdandi, Weird, and Skurd. And this is the idea that fate is pulling you on. You are fated to do this. Even if you don't recognize it, you are fated to do something. And it's also being called by the gods. So you have a purpose in life. And I'm speaking to everyone listening to this when I say this. You have a purpose in life, and you may not know exactly what it is, but there is a purpose, and you just need to listen out for those murmurings, you know, upon the wind, symbolically, which are calling you to meet that purpose, to meet that ambition that's been laid out for you. And this is what happens to Nook in the story. He doesn't know why he left Modersley. He has no purpose of where to go. He has no weapons and nothing like that. He's not prepared for this journey. He just knows that he has to go somewhere. And when he's in the forest and he hears this call, this is kind of the first reassurance that he gets that he is actually doing the right thing. And he still doesn't know what that thing is or why he's doing it, but it's a reassurance nevertheless that he is on the right path.
Yeah, I would certainly kind of echo those callings as well, those murmurings on the wind, which I've at various different times, I suppose, done my best to ignore, but the murmurs eventually become a shouting, and it becomes impossible to neglect your particular weird. Really.
Yeah, like in 2020, yeah. Right? That's when for most people those murmurings became a shout.
Very much so. At this part in the story is where Nook enters the forest. And the forests are generally symbolic about mystery, the unknown, and also loneliness as well, which I feel, you know, plays its part as well here, because Nook is essentially kind of alienated from his hometown and the people in his town. And the first named tree here is the ash, which blows across Nook's path at this point. So the symbolism of the ash tree does vary between different cultures, but you know, physically it's a tree that has roots that seep deep into the ground. So it's often connected with the ability to dig deep within oneself in order to find nourishment or stability, which we certainly see from Nook at these during these first steps in his adventure, during his various different moments of doubt. And there's a Druidic phrase as well, which is associated with the ash tree, which is "know yourself and you will know the world."
I didn't know that. That's fascinating.
And also as well, I mean, the ash is connected with Yggdrasil in Norse mythology, as far as I understand. So I was thinking perhaps the ash being blown onto his path perhaps indicated that he was going to be, you know, traversing the various different realms, or maybe that was unconscious as well.
No, you're right there. That was the initial reason for naming the ash tree at that point, is its association as the world tree, the Yggdrasil of Norse mythology. It's also the tree that's closely associated with Woden, who is, you know, that he's the god of mysteries. He's the all-father. He is the, and he is an archetype which is associated with the god Woden, does play a role in this story. And this shouldn't be mistaken for me saying that the gods are archetypes, but there are archetypes within stories which are reflections of the gods. The idea of evoking Woden here was quite important. There's another aspect to it as well, which is that, as far as I know, and I'm not an expert, but as far as I know, spears were typically made from the wood of ash trees. For whatever reasons, I had a dog who sadly died several years ago, but we named him Askan, and Askan is, I believe, it's most closely related to Swedish as a name meaning spear of the ash tree or ashen. So there is this association between the ash tree and the spear. And this is a theme which we'll be talking more and more about during this conversation, because just to kind of give the game away a little bit, Nook himself starts to embody the spear. So when, you know, by being welcomed into the unknown, into the forest by the ash tree, that's a hint at this aspect of it.
Oh, fantastic. I didn't realise the connection with the spear there. And obviously Nook becomes the embodiment of that spear, the spear of destiny, which is thrown later on. Mm. He's being thrown at this point, I suppose, right?
Yeah.
So the next tree that he encounters is the yew tree, and this is where he's seeking shelter from the winds and these stampede of hooves which he hears, which I presume is a reference to the Wild Hunt.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so the yew tree is associated with death, rebirth, and resurrection, and it's sometimes referred to as the tree of life. And the yew tree is present on the front cover of the book as well, along with the swans that we encounter later. And I presume that's Furrows' skull on there as well.
Yeah, I'd have to ask the artist, Clarissa Beber, about that. But yes, yeah, that would be the skull of Furrows.
Yeah, so I actually visited a yew tree in Perthshire in Scotland before embarking on my own quest into the unknown realms, and which I retrieve some particularly insightful information, but I won't go into that now though. But the tree is apparently, I think it was 2,000 to 3,000 years old, and it's supposedly one of the oldest living plants in Europe. So the key to the long life and this notion of death and rebirth of the yew tree is due to that whenever the tree breaks or fractures or it succumbs to disease or infection, certainly whenever it kind of breaks or fractures, it will actually branch out another kind of branch from that point, really. So even when it's being damaged or destroyed, it just grows new life. Even if the trunk dies, a new trunk will grow. So yeah, they're extremely resilient, to the point where the yew will actually outlast fence posts that are made of iron. So it's called the yew of resistance.
Mm.
At this point, as I said, it was sheltering from the stampede of hooves. And there's this wonderful bit of imagery that you have here as he's parting the branches of the yew tree like curtains. So this is almost like the dawning of a new day, or it's the opening of the act of the next part of the play. And as he opens the curtains, he sees this figure sat on the trunk of a fallen tree.
Yeah. So the yew has always fascinated me. I remember being very young and my granddad telling me that longbows were always made of yew wood, and you know, as a young boy I was fascinated with archery and things, so it always stuck with me that the yew is a particularly special tree since I was young. And as I grew older and I realized that I came to understand that most churches in Britain are built by or on a site near yew trees which probably have stood there long before Christianity darkened these shores, should we say. And so the yew has always been sacred, and it's always been recognized as sacred, not just by the pagans of native Europe, but also by the incomers, by the Christians, who knew that they had to kind of commandeer these sites next to these sacred trees to retain any kind of authority over the nearby people. So our people have always recognized the sacredness of the yew tree. So it was really just including a yew tree at this part of the story is really just to kind of punctuate the fact that this is a sacred place where something particularly mystical and sacred is about to occur.
Yeah, that's interesting that you mentioned that about churches being built at the sites of yew trees. There's incredible yew trees around Roslyn Glen, which is at the site of Roslyn Chapel. Which is featured, I believe, in the film of the Da Vinci Code. That's where it's became famous.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, I remember that.
Quite a terrible film in many ways, but
yeah.
But yeah, this is where, as I said, he opens up the curtains of the branches of the yew tree, and he encounters Lastance. Thank you. distance, who you describe as being a tall, slender, grey hooded man. So I'm presuming Odin, or at least having Odinic aspects to his character. And this, I would say, so I call this the wizard at the door moment. This is like where Gandalf shows up in The Lord of the Rings. Yeah. Or you have, Obi-Wan in Star Wars. Essentially, these characters are essentially a catalyst to adventure, and they push the hero forward in their quest.
Yeah, completely. There is nothing original about the inclusion of this character Larstence at this point in time. I'll say to you at this point, Adam, I think that we're going to have to do this in two parts, because we're just sort of coming up to about halfway through our talking points here, and we've been talking for nearly 2 hours. So I'm going to suggest that once Larstence has performed his dastardly deed, that we cut this episode and come back for another one. Would that be okay with you?
That's perfectly fine.
So yeah, let me talk a bit about this, because this is me including, this does feel a little bit self-indulgent to say, but it's not, and never was intended to be. But I'm just drawing upon what I can, which is my own experiences, as all of us do. It's only natural. The very first sort of shamanic type journey that I had when I was first investigating pagan practice, I had a very vivid experience after practicing sitting in a meditative state for, I would do it daily for a period of time. And I got to a point where I was able to have these very vivid experiences. And in one of them, I encountered an entity who revealed himself to me as Larstence. And in that experience, he wasn't actually an old man. He was a kind of a, I don't know, he was actually probably about the age that I am now, even though the experience, the journey that I had was about 20 years ago. So he was older than me at the time, bearded with short hair. So not me, not myself, but he was a guide. And he was he felt like a wise man, and he introduced, and at the time I took him for a fetch or a spirit guide, because we talk about spirit animals, but it doesn't always, a guide doesn't always have to be in the form of an animal. It can be a very human looking entity as well that we can encounter. So that's where the name came from. Now, those of you who've listened to the podcast entitled Divine Encounters will have heard my story about meeting Woden. And some of you will balk at the idea that I could actually meet one of our gods. You do you. I was very skeptical at the time initially as well, but after some time, I came to realize that the only sensible explanation for the experience I had when I was at Wayland Smithy in Berkshire several years ago. This was, I think it was in 2013. And I was there late one night performing a feigning with some friends to Woden and Wayland. And this was a Saturday night. And then a very elderly gentleman just appeared very close to us without having made a noise approaching. So I drew upon that experience for this. And when you look at the lore, the Northern European sagas and stories, you find that Woden is generally accepted to manifest in human form in the world of men, more so, I think, than any of the other gods or goddesses. It's something that Woden is known for doing, and I believe that he did so to me. He revealed himself to me. He appeared in human form. Very tangible, not a ghost or anything. It was a man. And so I drew upon this experience for this part of the story with Larstence. And yeah, it's very much as Adam said, it's the wizard at the door moment. It's the moment where a mystical character, an inexplicable character, you don't know why he's there or what his purpose is, but he is serving some kind of purpose, which becomes more apparent later on. So yeah, that's really about the summation of Larstence, for the purpose of this conversation, I would say.
Sure. Yeah. I loved that. description of you meeting Woden during the Divine Encounters episode. Absolutely incredible. And the way in which you present the Woden type character here is he's almost got aspects of the as well as the wizard, it's also got aspects of the trickster archetype as well. And this is, it's actually a fairly common conflation. And we can actually see this present through the presentation of Merlin in and John Borman's Excalibur film. He's kind of a trickster, quite jokey character, full of kind of riddles. The trickster is that he, you know, he actually pushes Nook into the river, the waters, the deep, which you know, I was seeing as a being symbolic of the subconscious mind. And I mean, this action at the time, especially as from the perspective of both the reader and Nook at that time, is, you know, perhaps seen as a malicious act. However, when we, you know, later in the story, that's kind of recontextualized, and it's essentially the necessary push into the unknown, guiding him towards his destiny. And this is, you know, helping Nook to overcome these forces of kind of stagnation, and it's forcing him directly into a challenge. And also, as I mentioned, he was very much in his own mind at that point, with this inner monologue, but being kind of thrown into like the rapid kind of rivers. Just you're in the moment at that point. You don't have time for that inner dialogue. And also at this point as well, he throws off his leather cloak. Which, as I mentioned, had that association with the earth symbolism and the ball furrows as well. So we've gone from the earth and in the first chapter, we've gone air in the second chapter, and now we're being plunged into water.
Yeah, you have a real talent for kind of tying these things together, Adam. You really do. I think at this point we've neglected to mention the fact that until he meets Larstance, Nook is not known as Nook. He's simply known as the Stonemason. And this was actually one of the most difficult kind of technical challenges I had as an inexperienced author, was finding new ways to refer to the Stonemason for such a long period of time, rather than calling him by his name, because I had to find new creative ways of referring to him, because continuing to call him the Stonemason at every turn just felt very kind of abrupt and clumsy. But anyway, the reason for that was that there is a reason that I made him a Stonemason, and I actually admit that right now I can't remember exactly what that reason is. I think I think the intention there was to do with the fact that he is a builder. He is someone who can build something new and great. But there may be more to it than that, which I might remember later on in the conversation in the next episode. I'm just interjecting here during the editing phase of this podcast to mention that I did in fact remember why I made Nook a Stonemason, and it's simply because his ultimate purpose during the quest, his ultimate doing here, is that he wields a stone chalice, the White Stone. So it's just a foreshadowing of the fact that he is capable of wielding stone in a profound way. Yes, he does. He throws off his and by the way, I named him Nook, and Nook is a very like I kind of struggle with this when I was trying to choose a name for him, because Nook seems like a very silly name, right? But then when I think back to The Hobbit, and you've got all of these hobbits who've got silly names, you know, the Proudfoots, you know, or the Proudfeet. And the Bagginses, and the very, very kind of playful, childish names. So I thought, well, okay, if Tolkien can do it, then there's nothing wrong with me doing it. And the reason I went with Nook was because I wanted something unique, simple, that also felt Northwest European without being too kind of pretentious or contrived. And it was meant to evoke the playfulness in Nook. So as we've discussed, you know, he comes from this very kind of stagnant, overly serious, mundane town called Modersley that's beaten the life out of everyone. You know, his wife no longer dances because, you know, this kind of beauty and playfulness is no longer present within the people there. And it's, again, it's just an allusion to the fact that Nook himself was once playful and he was once full of joy and he was once explorative and curious, you know. So this idea of having a nickname which he was given because he liked to hide in nooks, he liked to explore and find every nook and cranny that he could. And that's where the name originated from. And Larstence knows his name without having met Nook before. So again, this just reaffirms the idea that Larstence is a kind of mystical character who knows about Nook's fate and is therefore playing a conscious role within it. When Larstence pushes Nook into the river, into the torrential river, this is the tough love moment. And the idea here is, and this very much ties into the Alu or Ula runic formula, where Uras, you're in a stagnant position, you're not achieving anything, life is mundane, or the wider society is mundane and stagnant and not going anywhere. And the only thing that's going to catalyze a change in that, and this is, you know, this ties into the alchemy of it all, the only thing that's going to catalyze a change in that is something quite abrupt and unexpected, something kind of unconscious. And that's what this push by Larstence is meant to represent. In the moment, Nook thinks that he is being assaulted for no good reason. He can't see the sense in this old man having lured him to the edge of a river and then pushed him in. Later on, he'll come to realize exactly why it needed to happen. And it's the same thing where, you know, if you've got a friend who is, you know, perhaps suffering from physical ill health or psychological ill health, and they're not helping themselves, they're in this period of stagnation, they're in the Uras stage of things, and they can't find a way out of it. They can't dig themselves out of a hole. And sometimes the only thing that's going to cause them to dig themselves out of that hole is some extreme tough love, someone coming along and making fun out of them for their weight, perhaps because they're obese, or a partner leaving them because they're letting their clinical depression get the better of them. And you know, when we're in those kind of horrible situations, we think that there's nothing we can do to get out of them. But when the need arises, when something really abrupt comes along to force our hand, where we literally have no choice, when that tough love comes along, at the time we think it's a horrendous thing that someone's done to us by mocking us for our weight, or leaving us for our psychological problems, or something like that, or, you know, losing a friend because they can no longer put up with the way that we are emotionally and psychologically. But it takes that thing sometimes to catalyze change. And that's what this represents. That's what Larstence is. It's being thrown, being forced into an uncomfortable position where you can do nothing but change. And in this part of the story, that is represented geographically. Nook is taken from one place by the river to another. And that's, you know, that mirrors his psychological state as well. It's the moment of change. And he realizes later on why it had to happen.
Yeah, certainly that's something that I've been contending with. Certainly aspects of that is certainly things I've been contending with myself for some time, despite all the various signs and synchronicities that have been guiding me towards the particular path that I'm on. And, you know, considering the amount of personal synchronicities that we've shared over a period of time and the obvious entwining of our words in some sense. I mean, I was seeing this conversation as quite an auspicious occasion. And when I read your book, I just thought it was wonderful. And I really wanted to give it the necessary attention that it needed, really. And also to recognize the importance of the bard and to uphold the bard in our culture.
Well, I thank you, Adam. Again, I can't thank you enough for agreeing to do this conversation. And I have absolutely no doubt that you are the perfect person that I could get to agree to do this. So I really am grateful. But let's end this episode there. I think we're up to about 2 hours now. And I hope that people have enjoyed this. I hope that people are getting something out of it. I'm certainly enjoying it immensely. And hearing all of the connections that Adam has made is truly fascinating and humbling as well. So I really thank you, Adam, and let's save the rest of the story for a separate part two discussion.
Sure thing. Let's reconvene later on and we'll see where the river takes Nook.
Excellent. Okay, great. Well, thank you everyone for listening, and I hope that you did enjoy this and that you tune in for part two of this this podcast episode. So thank you all. So to finish this episode, as always, we'll take a look at last episode's riddle. So to the Exeter Riddle Book. And the answer given that is apparently almost universally accepted is bagpipe. And looking again at the riddle, I would agree with that. We have lines like, her shape was extraordinary. Her beak was pointed downwards, yet she cannot fly nor even move much. She goes the rounds at gatherings of men. She sits at the feast and awaits her turn. So I think this kind of plays into that very typical old English style of riddle where there's a really bawdy aspect to it. And it's playful and it's poetic and it's very figurative. And I really like it. So that's that one. So not really much more to be said about that one. I will reserve speaking more on that. The riddle for this episode, number 32, goes as follows. This world is adorned in diverse ways, decorated with rare ornaments. I saw a strange contraption, an experienced traveller, grind against the gravel and move away screaming. This strange creature could not see. It had no shoulders, arms, or hands. On one foot this oddity journeys most rapidly, far over the rolling sea. It has many ribs, and a mouth in its middle, most useful to men. It carried food in plenty, yielding tribute to all people, year by year, enjoyed by rich and enjoyed by poor. Tell me if you can, O man of wise words, what this creature is. I usually don't hazard a guess after I've read the riddles, but I think this one is kind of obvious, to be honest. Has many ribs, journeys far over the rolling sea, has a mouth in the middle useful for men, carries food, enjoyed by the rich and enjoyed by poor, an experienced traveller, decorated with adornments. Grinds against gravel, so when it comes to shore, obviously makes a noise when the hull of the ship scrapes along the bed of the shore. So I think that one's a boat. I think, I imagine most of you would probably agree with me on that one, but we'll find out for sure in the next episode, number 33. And as always, I thank you all for listening. to the Fergen podcast, and more information can be found at fergen.com, F-Y-R-G-E-N.com. Until I speak to you again, be well.